Fortunately for me, right?
Because you weren't radical enough.
No, we just sort of, it's like you have a relationship with somebody and it just sort of unravels or something. And you suddenly think, God, I haven't seen so-and-so in a couple of years. I wonder why we're out of touch.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised when President Hanna left? At the time he did, or?
I was, because nobody had ever raised the question, what are we going to do when he retires? Mm-hmm. He was old enough, I think, he was old enough that he could have retired under... See, we didn't have firm rules about retirement back in those days. But they came in when we became part of TIA, CREF, and Social Security sometime in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. But I guess I was surprised. Without really thinking about it, I guess I just assumed he'd always be president. He'd been president since 1940 or so.
And then in the interim period, Walter Adams, were you involved?
That was a shock to a lot of people.
That Walter became interim president.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Some were people who thought they had a claim on the job. Mm-hmm. Killingsworth was one of them. And they were passed over, and we had a provost who was had gotten his PhD in our department. Got him to, God, I'm terrible about these damn names. Anyway,
we can look it up.
And he was, as far as I could see, he was a perfect good provost, but he was passed over because the Democrats had 5 members on the board, and they had developed an animosity toward Hanna. I never was clear exactly why, but they couldn't stand Hanna. And this provost struck them as being part of the Hanna regime, so they figured if we finally got rid of Hanna, we're not going to perpetuate him by making this guy president. So this guy left and went out to Claremont Men's College. So then when Walter was appointed, he was as amazed as anybody, because he'd never been a department head or dean, had no aspirations to be an administrator, and he was out at Oregon State denouncing monopolies or something. They called him out there and said, you're the acting president. And he called me and he said, I don't know whether to take that seriously or not, but anyway, he was. Well, then it turned out the people in agriculture were very nervous because they said, you can make a pretty good argument, I think, that agriculture as a part of the Michigan economy has been dwindling for years and years and years. Now it's not really all that important to our economy, yet the ag college keeps growing. So they were fearful that he would consider this wasteful or something and they wouldn't benefit. And the engineering college was in danger of losing its accreditation in those days. So they were worried. So he had plenty of opposition among the faculty. There was even a time when he was, an effort was, well, you can't say launched, but was attempted to impeach him, yet a vote of no confidence from the faculty in his presidency.
Mm. Do you remember what brought that on?
Oh, yeah. Let me put it this way. When Walter became acting president, they later made him president. But when he became acting president, the first thing he did was he called the head of the campus police. It was a guy named Burnett, who's still alive, by the way, Burnett. And he said, now, before, we're going to have some demonstrations. These are turbulent times. But I don't want the police called out because that's too provocative. So before you send the police to any demonstration, clear it with me first. And they installed a red phone, in his house, etc. So the police were never called. There were three demonstrations, any one of which could have just exploded. One of them, it might have been within a month of his appointment, some black employees in the Wilson Hall cafeteria claimed that they were being mistreated by white supervisors. And they went to their local union, 1585, which was a union by the bosses back in those days. And they tried to get a file of grievance, and local 1585 wouldn't do anything for them, except take their dues, of course. It sounds kind of anti-union, but you can get a little pissed off at some unions, the way they behave sometimes. So they were still grousing, and finally, some of the black athletes who were living in Wilson Hall, that apparently was a place where there were a lot of athletes, white and black. The black athletes decided they would take this matter in hand and they'd do something about this. So they hit upon the idea of a sit-in in the cafeteria. So they staged a sit-in. Walter was called to, you know, alert him to the potentially dangerous result of all this. So he went over by himself, didn't even call the campus police. He went over there to see if he could resolve this. So he gets over there, and sure enough, the place is wall-to-wall black athletes in the cafeteria, and outside were a bunch of white athletes just spoiling for a chance to go in there and beat the hell out of these black athletes. Tells you something about how hard it is to break down these racial barriers. Mm-hmm. The guys, you know, like you talk about the Vietnam War, how the blacks and the whites shoulder-to-shoulder. I think that's a lot of baloney myself, but mm-hmm. you can't get a straight answer out of a Vietnam veteran on that either. But anyway, mm-hmm. so he decided, I will spend my time keeping these white athletes calmed down so they don't go in there and start a fight with these other guys. I think he was there for 24 hours straight. Well, toward the end of the second day, he decided, we've somehow got to get these guys out of there and resolve this whole thing. So we hit upon the idea of creating a tripartite panel to conduct a hearing in the cafeteria, because they weren't going to leave until they got some kind of a resolution of this. So they held the hearing. He pointed to, two housing administrators, white, two black, I think one might have been an administrator and a grad student, they're blacks. And then to chair this, he appointed a guy who was the vice president for student affairs, who was a lawyer and a former FBI man. And he figured this guy will know how to conduct a hearing and respect the requirements of due process and all that. So he appointed him. Well, the blacks then said, wait a minute, that's not a balanced panel. You got three whites and two blacks. So we appointed a black grad student as co-chairman. And I was three and three. So they hold the hearing. Well, one thing that occurred was somehow these two supervisors, who are now defendants in effect, got a lawyer to come out there. And as the guy started to enter the cafeteria, some of the black students said, hey, wait a minute, what do you got in that briefcase? You got a tape recorder in there? And the guy said, oh, no, I wouldn't do a thing like that. Well, let's look. So it opened up. Sure enough, he has a tape recorder. So they conducted the hearing and so on. I don't know how long it took. A couple hours, I think. The panel then retired, and they came back with a recommendation that the evidence showed that these supervisors had discriminated against these black employees. So the solution they recommended was transfer these two supervisors to jobs elsewhere around the campus at no reduction in pay or grade, which I thought was an inspired idea. I mean, you've got a situation where how the hell else are you going to get those guys out of there? Mm-hmm. And I have a fondness for tripartite panels anyway. Well, all hell busted loose. People in the legislature were demanding to know, why did this professor, President Adams, coddle these blacks when they were violating the rights of others? They should be routed out of there if it took cold steel, you know, all that kind of talk. Our department head, a guy named Lanzalotti, wrote up a statement of no confidence in Adams. Adams called a special meeting to respond to all the complaints about how he handled it. He got threatening letters. He got letters denouncing him as a goddamn Jew and all kinds of just nasty stuff. In letters in the state news and letters to him personally and all kind of thing. So finally this guy, Lanzalotti, Walter decided, I'm going to hold a meeting of the Academic Senate and I will explain why I did what I did. And that'll defuse this whole thing. So I go over there and here's my department head, Lanzalotti, and one of his supporters with a huge pile of these statements. Vote of no confidence, but a statement explaining, you know, whereas and all that kind of thing. Well, it turned out Lanzalotti, for some reason, didn't have the nerve to distribute those, so that nothing came of that. But people got up in the meeting and denounced Adams for adopting some kind of affirmative action policy and bringing black students to the campus who were not prepared to do college work and so on. And he responded to that by pointing out that there was such a program, but it started under Hanna, this icon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Detroit Project or Project Ethel, probably?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing blew over. Uh-huh. Was I responding to some question you put
in? Yes, we were talking about the attack on interim President Adams. Vote of no confidence.
Yeah, there was another one. Talk about elements of farce. I think it must have been SDS found out that the Oakland, California Police Department had sent recruiters to Michigan State to interview students in police ad or whatever they were who might want to go to work for the Oakland, California Police Department. So they found out that these interviews are going to be held from 2 in the afternoon or something on a certain day in the student union. No, the student services building. Mm-hmm. They'd reserve a
placement
room.
Placement office. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they'd reserved a room there for these interviews. So a huge mob of, 200 or 300 students showed up over there to object to the... Oh, about a week before these interviews were to be conducted, an article appeared in some magazine, some national circulation magazine, identifying the Oakland, California police as the most racist in the nation. That's a week before these interviews. So you can imagine in those days what that would produce. So here are about 300 students. It was wall to wall. You couldn't get down the hallway unless they made a big effort to get out of your way. So I was teaching a class over in Erickson Kiva, and some guy came over and told me, God, all hell is busting loose over. You got to get over there. I was considered a guy who could quell, calm down excited students. I'll tell you, if you can stand it, I'll tell you the incident that shows that there was some truth to that. But anyway, I go over there, and they let me make my way down the hall, but it was really difficult. They were so packed in there. And I get down down there, and here's the door to this office, which is open, and Adams is standing in the door, and people are all around him. And we had a visiting professor from India, a guy named Durendra Sharma, at that time in philosophy, who was kind of a radical. He was always, you could always count on him to show up at an anti-war demonstration and so on. Well, here he was standing, he was supporting the students, see. And he had he might have been a copy of Ramparts, but it was some magazine, and he's fanning Adams. And I kept thinking of these guys in India, you know, those movies where the guy's pulling on a rope.
With a big fan.
And there was a woman student, kind of a chubby, unattractive little woman. And the temperature in there must have been 90 degrees hotter than hell. She's wearing a leopard skin coat. And she's screaming at Adams, "You're a dirty, no good fascist. You'd burn Jews in the ovens," and all that kind of thing. And so I figured I've got to help out somehow. So I managed to get in behind Adams, and I put my arms against the sides of the doors and prevented people from... They were going to go into the office and, I don't know, have a sit-in in the office, I suppose. So I figured I'm trying to help him that way. So then I thought I had a brilliant idea to settle this whole thing. I said, "I have a suggestion for you." I said, "Why don't we suggest to the Oakland interviewers that they go on down to Ann Arbor and hold interviews down there, and when they've completed that..." I don't know if they had any interviews scheduled, or if they probably don't have police ad at Ann Arbor.
No.
Then they come back, and while they're down there, we meet and we work out a policy to decide what kind of institutions are welcome to conduct interviews for jobs on our campus. And he quite rightly said, "No, that's not a good idea. These students have scheduled interviews. They're entitled to have those interviews. And I'm going to lead them in personally by the hand." He went out and he brought a student in, and they had the interviews. Meanwhile, I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what kind of a policy could you put together like that. And you can't, you know. You sure as hell can't deny a government agency mm-hmm. freedom to conduct interviews in a state university. Mm-hmm. See, I myself had just assumed the CIA recruited elsewhere, but mm-hmm. I couldn't say in a policy. Yeah. CIA can't recruit on the campus. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing died down, that was that. But he handled that with great skill, I thought. Mm-hmm. And then I can't remember, there was one other incident. I think they were going to... They were going to try to invade Den Hall, which contains the offices of the ROTC, mm-hmm. or did then anyway. And he went over there, and he just kind of joked around with the students and got them laughing, and the radicals were, they could have killed him, the way he defused that thing. Mm-hmm. But no cops.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't visibly present?
Yeah. I don't think they were even...
Were there?
Okay. Now, we had an episode here in Bessie Hall where... Remember the Orange Horse 3 incident?
Were you aware of that? Or
oh yeah, I was one of the speakers.
Oh, you were? Oh.
Yeah, and I knew Ben Strandis, who was department head then. Mm-hmm. He was a likable guy. Mm-hmm. But as I got the story, they weren't given any reasons as to why they were denied reappointment. And I couldn't find out why they'd been denied reappointment. So when I was asked would I speak, I figured I'll talk about that. And try to persuade the department to give these guys some explanation or maybe an opportunity to explain their side of their being denied reappointment. Strandis wrote me a letter, and each letter was about this high. He must have, I don't know, he wasn't in good shape, I guess, at that time. It wasn't Bernie Engel, it was Strandis. Mm-hmm. Did you coincide with him?
No. Byrne was here when I came.
Yeah, well, Strandis was a campus liberal, which was sort of a peculiar aspect of that. But see, that was at a time when the university policy was, if you decide not to reappoint somebody, you don't give the person reasons, mm-hmm. even if they ask for them. Mm-hmm. They had a rationale, which I thought was totally idiotic, but anyway, that was the policy.
You know why it was called Orange Horse?
One of them, Fogarty, Grote, and Lawless, those were the guys' names. Yeah. And I think, I don't know if it was Grote or Fogarty, but one of them had written a poem called The Orange Horse that appeared in some little literary publication of some kind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's where they... See, I think some of the more intemperate students might have thought these guys were fired because of that poem. There's something about the poem too political, or mm-hmm. sort of conspiracy idea they tend to go in for sometimes. Mm-hmm. But
did the university have a formal grievance procedure at that time, or no?
No.
Did they naturally come to you, or?
Well, actually, I started writing columns and points of view before I became a columnist in mm-hmm. the State News, denouncing such events as the Orange Horse 3, the mm-hmm. fact these guys are told we're not reappointing you, but we won't tell you why, kind of an institution treats people that way and so on. And the Hildebrand case came up following that. Do you remember that?
No, could you talk a little bit about that? Or in general terms? But.
Well, see, I think one of the things first about the Orange Horse 3, I have a feeling these guys really weren't doing a hell of a lot. They were teaching, but that was about it. So you could make an argument that they didn't deserve to be reappointed, but the fact was, which bothered me, they couldn't even get that kind of a statement out of the mm-hmm. administration. Well, then Hanna was still president in, I don't know when the hell this was, it was in the middle 60s somewhere, when, let's see, how did this go? Oh, I know, he decided he would try to make the university a less authoritarian kind of institution. So he was going to introduce some small steps in the direction of faculty participation in decision making. And one of the forms that took was to change the title from department head to chairperson. See, head sounds like the boss, mm-hmm. the chairperson, and so on. Well, and I think the word came down from the administration that departments should write constitutions to govern the way they conducted their affairs, constitutions and bylaws. Mm-hmm. Well, the University College had a lot of new people who had been attracted to come here to teach as generalists. And a lot of them had pretty good, respectable degrees, and a lot of the old guard did not. They'd been hired with master's degrees, and they got a degree in education so the university could meet the requirements of the accrediting body. So the old guard tended to be fuddy-duddies, that's the way I perceived them. And the new people, who made up maybe half of this, some of these departments, you know, like ATL here and so on, they expected that they'd have a voice in decision-making and whatnot. And so when the time came to start writing these constitutions bylaws, it created a pretty unpleasant situation in some of the departments. Well, one of them was social science, where a guy named Hildebrand, who'd been a bomber pilot in World War II, who was somewhat older than some of the other new people, he took an active part in writing the Constitution for social science and the bylaws, which the old guard were not happy with. So he came up for reappointment, and he was denied reappointment with no explanation. He couldn't get any explanation, even though he asked for it. So he came to me, and I said, I think my first suggestion was, we'll go to the state agency that administers the labor relations law, I forget what it's called now, and we'll contend that he was fired for engaging in concerted activity to change the working conditions in his unit. That was the argument, which would bring him within the orbit of that agency. Well, that didn't get us anywhere, so I started writing pieces in the state news from time to time on the subject of the Hildebrand case and the Orange Horse 3. And there was a woman in natural science named Van Tassel who was also under the gun, and she was denied reappointment as well. So I kept writing about these, and finally, I don't know whether the ACLU got into this Hildebrand case, but it wound up as a lawsuit in federal court. The argument being that he was denied his First Amendment right of freedom of speech by being fired for speaking up in support of these bylaws, which bothered the old guard. Mm-hmm. And am I still responding to your question?
Yes, absolutely.
So, anyway, he had a trial down there, and the jury ruled in his favor. Now, the judge had said during the course of the trial, the plaintiff, he was represented by an ACLU lawyer from Lansing, the plaintiff has mixed up a claim of a 14th Amendment right, which would have been denial of due process.
Due process, right.
And a First Amendment right. So I want you to disregard, disregard the 14th Amendment right. Well, they didn't understand that or whatever. They ruled in his favor, and I think they awarded him some amount of back pay or something. Then the judge overturned that on the ground that the jury had misunderstood what they were supposed to be ruling on. So he appealed to the Court of Appeals, which I think they heard the case, but they ruled they supported the judge's ruling. A couple years later, he's back in federal court again. Sounds like the Florida situation. He got another favorable jury verdict, which the same judge, overruled again. He tried to get this up to the Supreme Court of the U.S. and didn't get anywhere. But I kept writing columns about this every time, and I was invited to, I didn't participate in the first trial, wasn't asked to, but in the second trial, his lawyer, whom I knew pretty well, we'd helped start the ACLU in Lansing here, asked me, would I testify in Hildebrand's support? Well, Hildebrand had written he had published a book, one of these Vantage Press publications, which turned out to be a collection of articles that he had published somewhere else. And then this last chapter was a talk that he gave at the end of the term, every term, to his students in social science. And I don't remember it too well, but one of the things that sticks with me was he told them, don't feel bad if you've only got a C, because employers are more likely to hire people with C grades than they are with A grades. it was just so low level. This damn thing contained articles supporting the Vietnam War with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. And this guy was, by this time, he's calling himself a radical, left-wing radical. So why he put that in that book, damn if I know. I read one review of the book by some guy somewhere who said, it's a damn shame that trees get cut down in the North Woods to make paper to publish books like this. So I said to his lawyer, I said, hell, I couldn't testify to that. Well, he said, how about this? He said, by this time I was FGO. He said, would you be willing to testify that if Hildebrand came to you as FGO, at the time, when he did, with some guy else being FGO, I can't remember, Bruce Miller or somebody, would you be willing to say that he should have been allowed to use the grievance procedure, even though he wasn't an employee anymore? And I said, I sure as hell would. He was denied that. The FGO wouldn't listen to him. Mm-hmm. Because he was, I thought that was a hell of a way to interpret that. Because the Hildebrand case was one of the cases that led to the grievance procedure. Mm-hmm. So I said, sure. So I went over to federal court, and it was a typical scene. You know, you got the administration folks over on one side of the gallery, and the pro Hildebrand people over here. So I was called to the stand, and I said, yes, I would have. I think that was the intent of the trustees when they adopted the grievance procedure. So I had no basis for knowing that there was their intent, but I assured I would have, you know, processed the grievance for them. So Lee Carr was the university attorney, and I'd known him because he would represent people in grievance hearings, and his approach was narrow the concept of a grievance to this razor edge point you could, and mine was widen it out. So you make a grievance any complaint somebody has that he's mistreated, whether the language of the grievance procedure seems to support that or not. And the term grievance was written by Killingsworth, who took it out of a union contract. So in a union contract, a grievance is something that violates the contract. But you can't file a grievance if you're mistreated, but you can't make it, you know, based on that. So anyway, Lee Carr says to the judge, he said, you know, judge, he says, Dr. LaRue, he's a fine man. He said, I like him, we're friends, but he doesn't know what the intent of the Board of Trustees was. Why don't we, if we're going to go into that, why don't we get somebody from the Board of Trustees who was there and ask him? So I happened to be driving back and forth with its lawyer. So on the way back, he asked me, do you think you could get somebody from the trustees who helped write that grievance procedure? He testified, and he said, yeah. I said, there's a guy named Claire White from Bay City. Did you ever know him?
Mm-hmm. I know the name.
I'm afraid he's dead now. Mm-hmm. But he hated Hannah, he hated the administration, etc. So I called him and said, would you be willing to testify in the Hildebrand case? And of course, he knew about it. He says, will I be able to stick it to the administration? I said, damn right. He says, okay. So it was like Perry Mason. We get over there. He drove down here and for some reason left his car here, and we drove over. I had a Mazda RX-7, maybe that's why we drove over in that. Well, as we enter the courtroom, Hildebrand's lawyer is just winding up his summation, and he'd probably been looking over his shoulder wondering if we were going to show, because I told him we were going to be there. Oh, he says, Your Honor, he says, Professor LaRue has just arrived, and he's brought Trustee White here, who will answer the question that you denied him or something. And I thought, that's all I need. Here's the goddamn provost sitting there. This troublemaker comes in and produces this witness. So Claire White goes on the stand, and he's asked by Lee Carr, was that the intent of the trustees? Carr knew there was no statement by anybody on the board that it was their intent, because he was in those meetings, you know. Claire White said, yeah, that was. That definitely was our intent. Under oath. So Hildebrand won that one, and the judge set that one aside. Mm.
So he
but anyway, going back to the grievance procedure, See, every time I wrote one of these pieces about Hildebrand or the Orange Horse Three or Van Tassel, I would send copies to the board members. I never got a response from any of them except Claire White. And I'd always include the president because I figured if I don't, one of them will show it to him anyway, so I might as well do him the courtesy of sending it to him. Mm-hmm. And never got a response from any of them, one way or the other. Mm-hmm. See, they seem to have a them and us attitude. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I kept them apprised, and finally, the time came when Don Stevens, who was an AFL-CIO official and a board member, and I think I raised the question, would the UAW allow an employer to treat its employees the way our Democrat members of the Board of Trustees allow the administration to treat these people? And I finally got to them. And one of the ways I got to them was the last piece I wrote about that, I figured I better not put my name on this because they've heard this same argument too many times before. So I got a guy named Chuck Crapo, who was in social science.